This is HPR episode 2686 entitled, Not All About Blender, Part the Second. It is hosted by Mirror Shades and is about 40 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, a meandering conversation to soothe the nerves and warm the soul, part 2!
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Yeah, there was some interesting stuff once. I used to play the original F-Zero for the Super Nintendo a lot, and so there's some weird stuff. Like you can there's a few places where you can get the car up to as fast as you can get it and hit the turbo right as you get to these little ramps. Uh-huh. And if you can find one that's like, sometimes the ones like right next, they're like staggered left and right on the side of the track. Well, if you hit it like cockeyed, like in the corner. Sometimes you can jump like whole sections of the track and land over here, and that got me wondering, like, okay. And I started an experiment, and I spent a lot way more time than I should probably admit to just fucking with that. And then one day I found, there's like, I wonder what happens, if will it let me, like, I found this one, I can't remember, it was one of the later tracks, and there's a huge amount of the track, like almost half the track that you can jump. And it's really, 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 really hard to do. And I sat there like all day trying to make that stupid jump, and it kept crashing out. Finally, I did it. And I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to see the game crash or something's going to happen. And it landed it. And obviously, the programmers had thought of that ahead of time. So this little weird, you know, in F-Zero, like the little section, like at the very beginning of the track that you can get over in, and the little beam comes down and heals your car. It looks like that, except the beam is red instead of yellow or whatever, and it drags you back.
It's like, no.
It drags you back to a certain point, and it's like, But it was funny that they actually had thought, you know what
they
I mean?
They thought about it, like, yeah, we're going to skip that right now. it's weird, too, because, like, looking at, like, menu editors, or, like, map editors for, like, different games, it kind of seemed like the kind of the hidden ways that they do things, and you're piecing together in your head, like, man, somebody sat there and thought, like, oh no, they're going to do this, so I need to put a, like, an invisible barrier there, and just to see.
Well, and to be fair, too, they have the guys that sit around and playtest that and probably find some of those bugs for them, but yeah, it is still cool.
Yeah, but it's kind of interesting to see, not only that, but the things that were, like, missing, like, the glitches that, like, apparently.
Oh, like unfinished levels and stuff that are still in games people discover?
There's apparently, I was watching a YouTube video of this where somebody was talking about in Mario 64, you have rows of coins that are always in groups of five, except for this one area where it's only four. And they thought, like, why are there only four there instead of, like, every single other batch is always in five? And they started checking the game code, and the way it happens is a certain XYZ position where they place a spawner, and then it will, like, branch out and, like, drop down the coins, and they can do it either in the line, or they can do it in a ring, or maybe one or two other shapes. But it's like that one, the way it was placed, it would drop down, but since one of them ended up being underneath the ground because it was, like, right on the ramp, so it just kind of, like, fell off into space and, like, despawned. And it would do that every time you approach it. It would spawn all five, one of them would fall through and despawn. And they was wondering, like, so that's a glitch. Like, they just moved it up, it'd be fine. But all the other markers in the game, they're always at a certain height. But this one's, like, placed really low. And they got to checking the rest of the area around it and determined that the ground on that level was at a certain height. But then they kind of went by later and like artificially raised that portion of the map. And it's has to do with there's a like a ball spawner, and then it would just kind of like the balls go in a track around the mountain. Originally, they were meant to go the other direction. And they determined this just by kind of seeing where the spawner should have been placed initially, seeing the angle of the ramp, and then realizing that it was actually decreased so that the balls would go the other way. And then they realized like half the level had been redesigned around that concept. All just because there were 4 coins instead of 5. And it's like, one, someone spent way too much time on that, and two, someone spent exactly enough time on that.
There's a lot of stuff, even today, like hidden stuff that still comes out. I think I read somewhere that there was still one hidden Easter egg, I think, in the original Mortal Kombat no one's found.
Yeah. Mm. And there was some really deeply hidden ones too, like, because I don't know if it was the first one, but there's something like you had to defeat somebody so many times, and then like a certain time, and like certain levels, and just certain combinations, and then like you fall through the floor, and then all this other stuff, but you unlock like an additional character or something like that, and it was just like ridiculous all the steps you had to go through.
Yeah, there's some really goofy stuff, like, and I think the first Mortal Kombat, we know that it's like the reptile's main character, and there's a bunch of clues to how to unlock him. Or, well, you don't really unlock him, you just get to fight against him. And then he's a regular playable character in 2, and there was 3 hidden characters in 2. But there was also some other, yeah, there's Jade, Smoke, and Noob Saibot in 2. And the weird thing about Mortal Kombat 2, though, it had other weird little Easter eggs, too. Like, if you fought 250 matches in a row
without losing,
you would stop and it would let you play like Pong, like the original Pong. And I think they had a similar thing like that in 3, but it was Joust instead of Pong because Midway was the big factor there.
Yeah,
Joust was an old Midway game.
That's a game they need to update for the modern generation. Fly around in that
Joust
souped up ostrich jousting thing.
I think it would be cool to see some of the old, like, there were some interesting games. Like, I remember my first console was Atari 2600, so yeah. Like there was some games like Activision had out that like Star Master. Nobody remembers Star Master, but Star Master was a weird game because it you're in a ship, so essentially your TV was like you're looking through the cockpit, basically. Yeah. It was like a first-person kind of thing. And you had a star map that you could bring up. And the way you did that, because, you know, the 2600s are limited, there's a switch on the 2600 that switches from color TV to black and white TV.
Yeah.
And in Star Master, they use that switch to switch between your regular view, looking out of the cockpit, and your star map view.
Nice.
So you flip the switch and there's the map of the area you're in, and you can there's like these little refueling stations that you have to hit because going to like there's little dots that represent the enemy ships that you got to destroy, and going to them from the star map zooms you there, so it eats up a bunch of your fuel, so you have to go to these little and you have to dock with them, which is really hard because it's hard to keep it on the screen and get it to dock and then refuel your ship. But they're usually, the enemy ships are in clusters, so they're like sometimes 1, sometimes 2, sometimes 3, and you'll have to destroy all of them. Once you get all of the map cleared, you've essentially beat the game, or you beat that part of the game. But it's not a, you don't get an ending, there's no real story, it just plays a stupid little doo 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 doo. That's it. That's all you get. That's all you get.
Did you have pride? Did you
get it? Yeah.
There's it actually sounds like a game called like Elite something. It was a first person space shooter kind of thing. But there was this whole concept where it's like in order to get to certain areas you constantly had to dock with like space stations in order to refuel, and when you first do it you have to match like the rotation and the angles, and you have to dock a really specific way or you crash. Like, you crash so many times you can finally do it. But the point is you're trying to buy cheap and sell, you know, buy low and sell high, but like in like different quadrants and stuff. You try to like plan out fuel usages and try not to get like hijacked by space pirates and all this until you can finally save up to buy a docking computer so you can, when you go, you're like, and it just dock for you. But the whole point of the game is just to, you know, acquire wealth throughout the galaxy. But there's not really much beyond that, but it's like you just kind of fly around, you know, in order to get to like the remote edges, you have to essentially save up, you know, through trades in order to, you know, buy fuel to get there. And I think there's like some warp gates that you can go to like other pocket universes kind of deal. And it's just, you know, it sounds kind of like that.
It's weird the stuff they came up with on that console, because it was so, like, there were some games like Megalomania 2 that was just like a shoot 'em up game. It'd be interesting to see that redone, or Demon Attack.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Demon Attack? That was kind of weird. These weird bird things. They would fly around the screen and poop on you, basically. You had to shoot them. And sometimes they would, when you shot them, they would destroy and they would reform.
That sounds weird. It's like you could shoot the wings off of them, or you could shoot them in the middle, and then the wings would die too, or something like that.
They would. Some of them, depending on which level you were on, you would shoot them, and they'd split into two smaller ones.
And was there like a spaceship at the end? And you'd have to.
I don't remember. I don't know if I ever got to the end. Let's see if I can find a. Yeah, Demon Attack was a. Was an old.
So Jar's Revenge.
Yeah.
That's one of those things where it's like they could legit make a movie. Just to expand on the backstory of that, because it's so iconic to, like...
Yeah, it's one of those things, too. Like, something about that game always... Like, you always got the impression there was this big story, but they didn't give it to you.
Yeah.
And you're, like... And you're trying to play the game, and you're just this bug thing, and... I mean, you can figure the mechanics out real quick. There's, like, this field that you can stay in, where you're relatively safe.
But you can't shoot. You're safe from that little pod thing that chases you, but
yeah.
You can't shoot. You can but still get hit by the laser
or the saw blade. Kind of thing. But that little thing that tracks you, that's what it does. Like, even though, like, if you touch it outside the field, it'll kill you. But if you're in the field and it touches you, that's how it tracks you to shoot you with the saw blade. So, like, you have to sit there, and once it fires, you just move out of the way. But,
See, I always thought the...
At least I think it is. It's been a long
time. I always thought just like you stayed still long enough, like it shoots you no matter where you was. And it's just one of those things where you're safe in the field, and that's kind of where it shoots you. Like, I didn't really know if that was...
Well, see, what I would always do is because you could... If you go up on the screen, you come out the bottom of the screen, I would just sit there at the edge in the field and then wait for that thing to get ready to fire and then just move up and then completely out of its way and then come over here and start eating the field again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you do. You sit in the center, you just race in the middle and stuff, and you're fired at it, and then you go and start blah, 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 blah. And then...
If you ate enough, you got a little missile that you could fire, and once you hit the little thing in the middle, it would go on to the next stage. I sit there one day, all day, trying to beat that game, and never got to an end, and it's my understanding that it doesn't really have an end, but
it's just alternates between, like, two different levels. It's like, I want to say, like, the force field was, like, kind of like roundish, and then like another one's like square.
Yeah,
you go back around and square, but like
the one that's rectangular is moving though. It's weird, you can't see
it.
When you start biting it, the little holes move back and forth.
Yeah,
and then the color changes eventually from red to blue on the field. I couldn't tell you how many hours I spent one day. I had the intention of beating that game and putting it behind me, and I never did get to the end. And like, I don't know how many. Let's look this up. I kind of want to know.
It was probably like 255, 256 to get to the kill screen.
Jar's Revenge, kill screen.
Or what it looks like. But yeah, like, because you can look at the cover of that game and like the box art, and it's got like the, you know, some kind of like insect dude flying around with like this little blaster in his hand. He's being chased by all this. Like, it just, there's something there. Like, they need to expand on the story. Like, all these years later, they just come out with like a sequel or something.
Like, all those games are like that though, because the graphics were terrible. So they put all these amazing, like, paintings on the covers, like, to drive your imagination.
But still, it's like all the games that one needs to expand on the most. Like,
it had some interesting effects. Like,
the sound to like,
like whenever you successfully shot the little ship thing in the middle, you ate through the shield. It had this crazy effect of these weird colors coming together.
Yeah.
You remember that when it would transport you to the next stage? And I didn't. That was blew me away because I didn't know the 2600 could even do that.
Oh yeah.
I was like. You know, I'm not finding the kill screen. I do not know.
Yarn.
There's a lot of images, though. Yeah, that is some killer artwork on the cover, even today. It definitely looks dated, but I mean, it's still. I don't know.
1982.
I think I got it probably around 84, 85. So it's kind of weird, like, probably the first video game I ever played was Pong, but it was, I remember as a little kid and I asked my mom for a 2600 for Christmas, and she was like, I could tell, I knew she wasn't, like, real enthused about that, and I was like, I don't want anything else, just the 2600 would be fine. And she was like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah. And that blew her away a little bit. But it's funny because, like, I was all excited to get this. And it was Christmas 1984. And, like, spring 1985, the commercials for the NES hit. So I got my 2600, like, right before the NES dropped. It's like, that figures. And that just set the tone for my whole life.
Yeah.
Really. It's like I got my NES in Christmas of 88, and that was like, if I'm not mistaken, that was a little bit before Genesis dropped, but still.
Apparently there's like mobile versions, like check that out.
Oh, that's pretty slick.
They have apparently made some new ones. They're probably like knockoffs, I don't know if they're like official, but still it's kinda neat to.
Yeah.
I swear one was like a straight like 3D game. There was a
Defender. It was like an Atari game that they put out for like the
actually,
PlayStation 2, I want to say.
I believe Defender was originally an arcade game that was ported to Atari.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the 2600 had a really, really, really shitty track record when it came to arcade ports. I mean, they had a lot of them and they all sucked.
Yeah.
The Pac-Man port sucked, the Frogger port sucked, the Mystical Man, Centipede. Yeah, Mystical Man wasn't too bad on 2600.
See, the thing is, I first played those games on the 2600, so.
Yeah. Well, some of them I did, some of them I didn't.
Pac-Man, I didn't have a chance to play Gattaca the other day, or Galactica, or.
Galaga.
Galaga, yeah. I was hanging out with my cousin and like his kid who was over like Game Town or something. You know, some pizza place like an arcade,
yeah.
And it's just like, well, there's no arcade cabinet, of course I'm gonna check it out.
Yeah.
And actually play it with like the stick and the buttons, which is like kind of unworldly, and then you get like, you know, younger kids and stuff like kind of looking like, What are you doing there? Like, you know, they're playing all these other flashy games. I'm like, I'm beating the shit out of these games is what I'm doing. And they're like, you just kind of get the impression it's like, you're a dinosaur.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good times, though.
I want, at some point in the future, to probably set up a main box. Like, you know, get an arcade
main
cabinet.
Stations.
Like, I've known some people who did that, or at least had planned on it if they ever finished it, but I've seen a lot of people take old arcade cabinets and get the new, because there's companies that you can buy the, like, newer mm-hmm. Mach-E's or get new ones made, like, have them customized to whatever you want.
Oh, yeah.
You can buy the whole, like, arcade stick with the button set up and their software. I think some of the cooler software they've made, though, for like main front ends or whatever for actual arcade machines for that usually runs on Windows, unfortunately.
There's some progress being made with like a RetroArch.
Yeah.
it's trying to unify all the game emulators, but it's kind of hit or miss. Where they're trying to abstract it out, I think it makes it more resource hungry. So
I recently discovered a very interesting NES emulator. You should probably check out Poonis. Poons? I don't know. It's like P-U and then NES. Don't know what the deal is, but I just discovered it actually on flightbuilds.org. I was like, what is this? This is a NES simulator I've never seen before. It could be old. It could be something nobody even keeps up anymore for all I know. But it's like, I really like the way the emulator's set up. It's like, this is kind of nice.
I think I was all about the Venus.
Oh, that's the Tigan now.
Yeah.
It used to be BeastNest.
It's weird because they'll change the name of projects. Like, you know, you were talking about Crunch Bang being Bunsen Labs, you know. It's just like, why don't I just keep it out? Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, actually, there's a story behind that because the original guy who did Crunch Bang was ending the project, and he said the community wanted to keep going with it, and he said he was fine with that, but they couldn't call it Crunch Bang, they'd call it something else. So in the, there was a couple of the editions of Crunch Bang were like named after, one was Statler and one was Waldorf. They were the old guys with the Muppets that heckled them or whatever. And so they
are not half bad. We're not half good either.
Yeah, so in the same tradition of using the Muppets, they called it Bunsen Labs after Bunsen Honeydew or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. I've told you this, but I really like Crunch Bang, but I'm not a Debian person, and I like Bunsen Labs, but I just don't like where Debian's going, so.
Yeah.
Just like that thing I told you. In the context of the Cathedral of the Bazaar, System D is kind of like a Walmart. It's like, yeah, you can shop there, but you're pretty much just doing it on your terms.
Yeah.
And that's why I keep recommending Void Linux. Use like backend runs, like OpenRC scripts or something like that, or run it. Something that's not systemd kind of gets away from all of that.
I guess why it pissed me off so bad was that when systemd came out, like we always used to say, Linux is about choice. Okay, well now my choices went down from, if I choose not to use systemd, my choice goes from 400 to 4.
Yeah.
It's like,
the problem with that too is like everybody moved away from 32-bit architecture to 64, which kind of makes sense, but it's like,
yeah,
you're just lost out on like so many devices that are still perfectly capable.
Yep. We're actually recording on a 32-bit device right now.
Nice.
Yeah. I have a lot of 32-bit hardware that I can still press into service. So I kind of went back to Slackware for now, hopefully. I don't think there's any plans to put systemd in it, but I'm fine with the BSD style on it.
Yeah. I also want to say that if you do systemd, it has to be 64. Like, I can't imagine there's too many that would still repackage it. It's like 32-bit.
Bunsen Labs has a 32-bit version.
Wow.
I think Debian still supports 32-bit for the time, I swear to that. But I know like some of the, like Linux Mint has 32-bit still.
Which one was the
But a lot of them will only support like the later 32-bit processors with PAE support.
Yeah, like, well, like I can see that too.
Bunsen Labs does have one that's non-PAE kernel though. You can get the old stuff.
Was it Debian that had like this super supported architecture where it was like you could install it on like anything on Toast?
I know they used to. That was, I don't know if they still do. I know some of the BSDs are like that. Like NetBSD is like that. That's their whole big thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like one of those things where like, can we install Linux on whatever? You know, nobody stopped to ask, should they? But I mean, the point was they could. So it's like, it became a distribution where it's like you can install on like, you know, PlayStations, Xboxes, cell phones,
Well, I think like too, NetBSD and I think at least Debian at one point used to support a lot of older architectures aren't around anymore, stuff like RISC and Alpha and shit like that. you know, really old stuff. But the problem is like, we're getting to a point now where even if you compile all this stuff and run on some of that old stuff, you're not going to get, the software's not going to run on it. You know what I mean? Like, even if I could get, say, whatever, I might be able to install Slackware on a 486 with 8 megs of RAM, but what am I going to actually do on there? Yeah. So it's like,
well, it's a matter of feature creep. Like, you get a project that, you know, it grows and it grows because people, hey, well, this is cool, but can we add this feature and this feature and this feature and this feature? And until it's so bloated, it's like someone else is like, well, we're like, we just kind of need to start from scratch with something smaller, so this is the direction we're going to take it, and get a third one that comes out, and then add another whatever. But over time, they just add so much to it that it just no longer runs. It's
well,
like,
yeah.
And there's a couple of cases where it's like, there's a package that has been like version locked, like, you know, no longer supported, but it doesn't have any, like, you know, hardcore known security issues. Like, they'll still do like security patches for it. Like, oh, you found a way to, you know, hack into it, let's cover that hole, but they don't add features and it just stays there. And then it becomes discontinued because, oh, this hasn't been updated in like, you know, 3 years, so obviously it's junk and let's go with this other thing, but it's like, it still worked though.
Yeah. I have that issue right now with, there's a emulator I really like called Kagan Fusion, and I don't think it's been updated. I don't think the code's actually been updated since 2009, I think.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that emulator because, the way he wrote that was, he was trying to really more emulate those CPUs than anything, so it's very accurate. I mean, I'm sure it's not 100% perfect, but, and the way it's set up, you can, with that one emulator, you can emulate the Sega Master System, the Game Gear, the Genesis or Mega Drive, whatever you call it, the 32X and Sega CD, and it's all there in one package, and all you really need is, I guess, the Sega CD BIOS.
Yeah.
And that's awesome, and I love it, and it does a really good job. It's got a high compatibility level. You know, I've not seen anything. I haven't run everything on it either, but I haven't seen anything that it hasn't run for me.
Yeah.
And I really dig it, but now one of the problems I'm running into is that it's 32-bit code, and it requires, like, one of the libraries that it depends on has moved on, and like if you're running, even if you're running like a multi-arch, you know,
system,
yeah, it's like the one of the libraries it needs is 64-bit, and it's you just take your hands up like, damn it.
Well, just like the Arch Linux were to 64-bit only, and you know, that's what I was running for a long time,
and trying to run Steam on it because I don't play a lot of games anymore, so you know, I play a lot of older games. But like, you know, every once in a while I was dabbling in Steam, and it was just like, they dropped 32-bit support, they don't do multi-lib anymore, so now it's a question of like, how do you get Steam on it, because it's like 32-bit only at the last time I checked. So there's all this like encapsulation you had to do, or like you had to run like basically a separate system within a system, and yeah, it just became this headache.
At that point, you're probably better off just running a 32-bit in a virtual machine or something.
Yeah. And it's almost like you kind of want to embrace certain things. Like Steam's one of those things where they kind of started putting out games geared towards Linux. You kind of want to support that. I mean, that's you would think that'd be like the main selling point, because like a lot of people is like, hey, why aren't you running on free open source software? It's like, oh, you know, I like my games. We have Steam, and you know.
Yeah, it feels like a shoot yourself in the foot kind of move.
Yeah.
In a way. I don't know. I get, like, everybody likes it shiny and fancy and latest and greatest, but, you know, traditionally Linux has always been, we're a little behind the times in hardware support, and that's okay. You know, we'll just wait for support for the newest.
Yeah, greatest. If you don't like it, you know, cobble up your own solution, and that's fine. But now it's getting to the point where it's like, if you don't agree with certain ideologies, you know, you're not a part of the community.
And
it's like,
I think this happened, a lot of this happened, not to point fingers and bitch, but like around the time when Ubuntu hit the thing right around the time Vista came out. And Vista was universally lauded as crap, and then a lot of people left, and Ubuntu was this easy-to-use version of Linux. Yeah. And a lot of people came to Linux through Ubuntu that way, but then they all started bitching about things. Like, I know that sounds bad, but it's like, why can't this be easier? Why can't it be like this and that? And I don't know. I felt like that's why some distros are a little more bloated than others when they're installed. And
catering, basically.
Yeah, it's like...
Which I can see that. It's like, not to be like ripping on any given subsection of like the community, but it seems like there's a certain point when you grow out of Ubuntu. Typically, I see people like, hey, what Linux should I try? And they go to Ubuntu, and then they'll typically jump up to Mint, or they'll realize it's based on Debian, and they'll like try that out. Or, you know, the distro hop, and then they might settle back into it. But if you've only been using Debian, or Ubuntu, or like Mint, there's a lot of other options out there. And without really seeing everything else, you kind of get locked into the mindset that that's all there is, and it basically becomes its own cathedral, where it's just like, you know, when they have a design decision, they're just like, support some, you know, like system D, and it's like, nobody's really saying, can we also run this other thing, or instead of, or, no, it's just pretty much, you know, support this across the board.
Too, that you run into this weird thing too, where like, systems like Ubuntu, where it's like all graphical, and a lot of the people who come to those, their mindset is the command line is a hindrance, and we don't want to rely on it at all.
Yeah.
We want graphical. You've excised the whole, like, you've that's a shoot yourself in the foot kind of move too, without realizing it. I'm not going to go into all that, but it's like it creates this schism where you've got people who are into the command line or comfortable with command line going. You get these distros where like things are like overly complex because we hate graphical. These people who bitch about things being graphical all the time.
And I'm a part of that.
And then like so the CLI doesn't really seem like it grows organically either, because it gets, you know, everybody who's involved with that gets pissed off because all these other people are bitching and wanting everything to be graphical. And then but that seems like what happens. So it causes problems across the board.
Well, there's two definitions of user-friendly, and they are diametrically opposed. There's user-friendly, like, you sit down on a computer, and it caters to you, and that's user-friendly. And there's also user-friendly in the sense where I work with a computer every day. Well, let me do it the right way, and that's friendly. Like, I don't strictly like Windows, because, you know, you try to use it, and it's like, They're catering to people that haven't spent their life in front of a screen, and they kind of do things it's intuitive, but it's not efficient.
But for me, it feels like I'm fighting with the operating system to make it do what I want to do all the fucking time.
Like, in Linux, like, I'll have it to where, like, when I boot my Linux box, it is just right to the command line. But it's graphical, you know, it's actually running, like, i3, or actually right now it's running Black Poison. But it looks like I just booted into command line, because that's where I do everything. Like, I don't need any graphical components, but like if I do want to, you know, surf the web outside of like, you know, W3M or, you know, links or whatever, you know, I load it like, you know, Chromium or something. But it's still command line, but it has the capabilities to like spawn graphical windows. And for somebody that's not used to that, they'll sit there and look at it and be like, okay, now what do I do? Like, what do I click on? It's like, moving your hand to click on something is just going to take more time. Just type it out real quick. But you have to be a fast type, or use a lot of keyboard, you know, shortcut keys. But if you're not learning shortcut keys, then it's like, you're never going to get better.
And ideally, the shortcut keys are something you can edit, like, your window manager, you can set your own hotkeys or whatever you want to call them.
Microsoft Windows, you know, Alt-Tab is always going to be Alt-Tab.
Yeah.
And if you don't know, like, Alt-Tab switches Windows, it's like, seriously, learn the key commands. But, like, I often do that in Linux. Like, I don't know Alt-Tab. I mean, it just makes sense. But sometimes I'll set it to something else. And I have that option, too. Mm-hmm. Like right now, like I like Vim. I'm just going back through and redoing my Vim configuration because, you know, I kind of noticed that there's better ways to do things. And it's like, if you want to do it that way, then just, you know, edit a text file and just everything works. And sometimes the, you know, troubleshooting, that's part of the process. That's how you learn, like, what you're actually doing. But it's like, my background is, I like computers because I like to see what they can do. Like, what, you know, I don't know the limitations. Let me find a way to glitch it out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But once you, like, start setting up barriers that you can't overcome, then it's just like, I don't want that. I want to be able to grow. You know, if it's something I need to learn, a tutorial I need to watch, some video, a book I gotta read, that's fine, but don't flat out prevent me from doing computing.
I think a lot of this too comes from a certain mentality of people have this daily driver mentality where I need a computer that just works every day to do these handful of things I need it to do, because we live in a world now where a lot of people's day jobs and their work or whatever it is they're doing requires these specific applications, and when they don't work, then they get in trouble because they're not doing their job or whatever. But, you know, that's really not the world computers grew, you know. They're not really a computer at that point, it's an appliance, and that's what we're...
Just like the internet appliance the early 2000s. But it's like I have to keep a Windows computer on hand for, like, job applications. Because a lot of times they'll, you know, hey, you got to fill out the survey to make sure that you're a candidate for this job or just something. Or, you know, set up your W-2 information, whatever. Links to a government website, click it, you can check the PDF. Then you got to sign off on it. And you're like, you can get like 50% of the way through like a pure Linux system. You know, sometimes you have to trick it and make it like, no, totally running Windows.
Yeah.
Or like, you have to, you know, do just some kind of like some tricks to it. Maybe you have to install like Mono or some kind of like Spotlight, kind of different things to get through. Just like trying to get Netflix up and running on like Linux was, you know, difficult for a long time. And then towards the very final end, you're like, okay, let me just put a signature on this, and it just doesn't work, and you're just like, I'm kind of done with trying to like troubleshoot my way around this. Let me just boot into Windows and just sign this piece of, you know, whatever, and just send off, and just, you know, none of those steps strictly require Windows, but it's like they force you to use Windows.
Yeah, cumulatively, it's a pain in the...
As long as they're using, like, you know, HTML5, you know, the actual specification, there's nothing there that says they should use one browser over another, or one operating system over another. I mean, you know, HTML renders as HTML do. So why do they even check what operating system you're running? It limits so much. But that's the way it be sometimes.
Yeah. It's kind of weird too. Like, it makes me sad. Like, the only way around that, I think, is, and it's part of the reason why, like, cloud computing has grown so big, mm-hmm. is because it's easier to deal with, it's easier to manage, and but I don't know, I can't imagine enjoying a computer anymore when all we have are Chromebooks. Like, you know, I'm still gonna tinker with it, but it's not the same.
It's like, why do we have to jailbreak a device just to use it?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and sometimes people, like, you know, they demonize people that jailbreak. It's like, oh, you're warning warranties, and, which is completely not enforceable. But if you have a device that you paid for and they're not letting you use it,
then you don't own it.
Yeah, you really own it.
You, like, don't own it.
And some there's people that say, no, you only really lease it from the company. It's like, then I don't want it.
Yeah.
Like, I want this other thing that's not going to limit me, because
if I'm paying my money for it, I want to own it. It's my property, and I should be able to do what I want. As long as it's not, like, hurting anybody else, what the hell difference does it make?
Yeah, but, like, you know, the hacking that I do is just trying to like push back the boundaries of my own systems. I'm not breaking into others. I'm not trying to push their boundaries. I'm just trying to, you know, keep my little space in check. And, you know, get off my lawn and stuff. Pretty much. So, yeah, Blender can do video editing.
And we have to bring that around full circle.
Yeah.
And,
Morrowind's pretty cool. That's the Morrowind project. Morrowind.org.
We'll put those in the show notes. And, and Yars Revenge links. Somebody needs to make a open
Yars Revenge.
Yes.
with a custom like level editor.
You can put the force field on the top of the screen or the side.
2 days later, you're fighting a Barney. In blood. Or one of the best Skyrim mods I ever saw was they changed the dragons into like Thomas the Tank or Thomas the Train.
Yeah.
Choo choo! It's like,
alright. We should probably end this thing.
Peace.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.